Well, it's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. Well, we're continuing our study in the last week of Jesus' life. And we've talked about Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and now we are talking about the Tuesday. We know that many of these questions were asked of him on Tuesday. And I have on the board that it became a day of controversy. And we've talked about a whole lot of the controversy, but we've not talked about all of it yet. And I think it's important that we see what a difficult day this was. And so if you'd turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 22, we are going to look at some more of the controversy involving this day. We've talked about the question of the Pharisees giving tribute to Caesar or not, their camaraderie with the Herodians to prompt that question. We've talked about the Sadducees' questions relative to marriage, and we've talked about the Pharisees, the lawyer in particular, who wanted to know what's the first and the greatest commandment. We've even talked about the response of Jesus in the latter part of that chapter. What think ye of Christ? Whose son is he? And then we've talked about the seven woes that we discussed in Matthew chapter 23. We didn't talk about all of them in detail, but simply to note how severe they were in the rebuke of the Pharisees, as scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites. And then I wanted to talk with you about this expression, this generation, because that is what we read toward the tail end of the 23rd chapter that introduces the 24th chapter. And I think that's something we need to identify. Debating about how much time I want to spend on Matthew 24, at least at this point in our study, but I do think it's crucial for us to know how the term generation is used in the New Testament. For example, let's begin our reading, if you would, in verse 29 of chapter 23. Matthew 23, verse 29. Jesus said, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye build the sepulchres of the prophets and garnish the tombs of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we should not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye witness to yourselves that ye are sons of them that slew the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell?" Let me pause right there with that question. And I don't think I made this point in our previous discussion of these verses, but when Jesus refers to them as serpents, offspring of vipers, that's not the first time they've heard that. You may remember that John the Baptist said that to them when they came to him to be baptized of his baptism, and he told them to go away and bring forth fruits worthy of repentance. And he used some very picturesque language like Jesus does in this passage. Resuming the thought in verse 34, he says, "Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them ye shall kill and crucify. Some of them ye shall scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah, son of Barachiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar." Now here's our point. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." Now, that's really important for us to see these, what I call bookends, that are in this last week of Jesus' life. Now if you go to verse 34 of Matthew 24, you see the backside bookend of the things that Jesus is discussing. He said, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished." Now, I call that bookends because really that's what that serves. The things that Jesus is discussing from verse 36 of Matthew 23 going forward into Matthew 24, verse 34, would come upon that contemporary generation. Now that makes it important. What's being discussed in the interim there? Well, we say the destruction of Jerusalem, and we've got that exactly right. So what we want to know then is that Jesus is not talking about the second coming. He's not talking about things pertaining to the end of time. he's discussing things that would come upon that generation. And of course, when we talk with the premillennialists and their use of the term generation, they say, well, that's an era of time. So what Jesus is saying to these Jews is this is going to come upon this era of time. It may be thousands of years long. No, that doesn't fit the context. When you look at what these are saying, they're saying, this audience right here is saying, if we had lived during the time of our forefathers, we wouldn't have killed the prophets. Well, now, are you saying that? Is that applicable to you? Or is it applicable to the people that were in Jesus' presence and their age group at that time? He's talking to them. They're the ones that have made this statement. If we had lived when our fathers did, we wouldn't have killed the prophets. He said, yeah, you would, because of what you're planning to do to me. Well, you're not planning to crucify Jesus, are you? So you're not included in that group. So Jesus is not talking about the second fall. He's talking about the fall of Jerusalem that would occur during the lifetime of some of those people. And that's what we want to note on this. You say, well, how do we know that that's how the word is used? That's how it's used by Matthew, I believe, in almost every, if not every, case that it's used. So it's not used to talk about a period of time. Jesus talking to these people. The lifetime of a man. And if you want to look these up, we'll take the time to look these all up. But I think you see that Matthew has used this expression consistently to talk about this generation or this lifetime of people. It's not extended over a long, lengthy period of time. Now, if you've got a question or comment on that, I'd love to hear it. Anybody, when you hear folks talk about a generation, do you think of thousands of years? What do you think about? Same thing?
When I was a kid, this came up at some point. My mom, I don't know where she got her figures, but something she had learned, she said, a generation is considered to be 23 years. And I think it meant, you know, it must have been some sort of average age that women first bore children or something like that. But that would be a lifetime. That would be, or you know, that from parent to child.
Yeah, basically so. Well, some have defined it 30 to 100 years. It's average lifespan of a man. And I don't know anybody well, I might if I thought about it real hard. That's 100 years old, but it would be, I'd have to think about it. That would be the exception. Generally, and of course the scriptures affirm this, that man lives some 70, or by reason of strength, some 80 years. That's a lengthy generation if we go with that figure. But what you're talking about is, I think, the image that we're trying to see. Yeah. That's what we're trying to see. And some of these people, they would see this occur. They would see the fall of Jerusalem. And can you imagine how horrible that must have been for them when Jesus has told them what's coming? He's told them what's coming. Now, let's not read Matthew 24 and come away with the understanding that Matthew 24 is always talking about the second coming of Christ. I think that's a mistake. And maybe it'd be wise for me to pause just here, because Matthew 25 kind of begins another thought just here, and I want to talk with you a little bit about that, but let's pursue just a little bit on this vein. We know that in Matthew 24, let's back up. Let me get my thoughts together. Matthew 23, look, if you will, at the next verse, verse 37. Matthew 23, verse 37. The very next verse, after speaking, all these things shall come upon this generation. Jesus said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets, and stoneth them that are sent unto her. Now, wasn't that just what we read back over here in verse 34? That's what they were doing. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets, and stoneth them that are sent unto her. How often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not? Now, that's a plea of compassion, isn't it? Jesus' desire for this city is that they would be saved, but they're not going to be. He knows what's coming, and he's about to tell them. Now, in verse 38, notice the expression, Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, for I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now, there are two or three things there. Number one, we want to see that he's referring... I'm sorry. Richard.
Well, I don't know how long Brenda's comment has been up there, but she says the Israelites wandered 40 years, and then she says, generation, question mark?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think so, because that generation... And I think that word is used to describe those people. I'd have to look back, and if she wants to look back, it'd be Numbers 14 is where you'd find that. Or Numbers 14. I almost said Numbers 21, but I believe it's Numbers 14 is where you'll find that. But I believe that's correct. We're talking about a lifespan of people, a general average age that people would live. So yes, I think that's true. Now, in verse 38, underscore in your thinking that expression, your house. We've talked about this before, and we talked about it when we were going through Matthew 21. And Brenda, by the way, thanks for your comments. I sometimes forget that we've got people online, because I can't see that. I don't know who they are, but I'm glad you're here. Yes, Randy?
So Matthew 21:23, he enters the temple. And Matthew 24, verse 1, he comes out of the temple. So he's in the temple this entire time, 21:23 to 24:1.
That makes my point. And you'll look at Matthew 21, verse 13, just prior to going into the temple, as he's come into the city, what has he said?
My house shall be called the house of prayer, but you're making it a robber's den.
All right, I want to underscore the expression, my house. Whose house is it? Well, it's the Lord's house. He's talking about the temple. But once he's been there and seen what they are doing, he says, your house is left unto you desolate. He's referring to the same structure. It's no longer my house. And I think we need to note that, because that says something about the temple. Initially, what was the tabernacle and the temple? What did that mean? What did it represent to the Jews?
God's presence.
God's presence. Now, when he says, my house, it's a house of prayer, but you've turned it into a den of robbers. Now, when he first refers to it as, your house is left unto you desolate, does the Lord dwell there now? We might take note of that. Lord, not with these people. Something's about to happen that they don't want, but nonetheless, they paved the way for it to occur. And if you'll look at verse 38, then he said, for I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Jesus knows what's going to happen to him. But his point is the temple is going to be destroyed. Now, Randy, to your point on the other side of the bookend, the coming out of the temple, verse 1 of 24, and Jesus went out from the temple and was going on his way, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. But he said, answered and said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, can you imagine if you were a Jew? And keep in mind the occasion that we're talking about. Would this place, at the time that Jesus is speaking, be well populated? Oh, yeah, we're talking about the observance of the Passover and the events leading up to the Passover feast. So, yes, multitudes of Jews were here. In fact, in Acts chapter 4, we learn beginning in verse 1 through, I believe, 5, that there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven gathered in this city to observe these feast days. So we want to take note of that. The city is full. And Jesus is looking at the temple, and he said, he don't live here anymore. And he refers to it as your house. It's not God's anymore. And then when he tells them that one stone is not going to be left upon another, and when you think of the structure of the temple itself, and it's not our purpose, and we'll not look at charts and all of that to see designations of size and gates and buildings of the temple, just create a visual in your mind. We're looking at something very large and great deal of splendor attached to it. Can you imagine the Jews hearing this? That the day will come when one stone won't be left upon another. Now, their question in verse 3, and as he sat on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, I'd like to talk with you about that, what appears to be two questions, and whether it is in fact two questions or in their mind associated together as one question. And I would suggest to you that perhaps there's the reality of two questions, but I don't see it as two questions in their mind. The reality of what they're asking is one question. What's going to be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? The end of everything. Now, if you were a Jew and you've come to these festivities in times gone by, it was quite an occasion of splendor. And now, Jesus is telling you that everything you're looking at is going to be destroyed to the extent that one stone will not be left upon another. What would you associate that with? End of everything. Yeah.
No. The New American Standard, verse 3, says the sign of your coming and at the end of the age.
Yes. Yes.
Next to the end, there's a marginal reference that says, oh, consummation.
Yes. Consummation of the age. You got the same footnote. And the point, I think, that the reality of the question is what they're seeing. This would be the end of everything. The end of the Jewish age. Did these Jews that were gathered together for these festivities, did they see Jesus establishing his kingdom as a spiritual kingdom? Not now. They did in Matthew 21, but not now. We're going to see soon, they're going to ask Pilate, crucify him, crucify him, or demand of Pilate, crucify him. No, they don't see Jesus as establishing anything at this point. And now he's telling them that that which represents the glory days of ancient Israel, it's all going to be destroyed. How would they perceive it? The consummation of everything. Consummation of the age. The end of everything. Now, interestingly enough, they want to know, when's this going to be? What signs are there going to be when this is to come to pass? Now, this is what Jesus begins to answer regarding their question. Now, I want you to look, and we'll not spend as much time as we could on this. As we were talking about earlier, I don't know that this belongs in this study as much as it does in the study of the doctrine of premillennialism and the abuse that so many have made of. But we do want to note some things in this passage. In Matthew chapter 24, if you'll note beginning in verse 4, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man lead you astray. Well, why? For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall lead many astray. Now, let's take note of that. Sometimes we, in our point in history, we don't realize that during the time of Jesus, there were others who claimed to be the Christ. Now, they were not. But Jesus said, don't let them lead you astray. There are going to be a lot of fellows claimed to be the Christ. Now, Jesus claimed to be the Christ, and we might note that this might cause rise for some to be speculative about his claims. But what was different about his claims and the claims of others?
He proved his.
He proved his, yes. John tells us many other signs, therefore, did Jesus in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. So Jesus proved who he was. He is indeed the Christ. Now, interestingly enough, if you'll note in John chapter 10, the question was asked, if thou art the Christ, tell us plainly. Well, what did they think the miracles were doing? He had claimed over and over and over to be the Christ and performed miracles to prove that it was so. And now, the genuine article, if you please, is telling them there's going to be others claimed to be the Christ. And don't let them lead you astray. They are not. In verse 6, then he says, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass. But the end is not yet. Now, if there were those come about today and said, I am the Christ, would you suspect that the end of time was just right on the verge of occurring? No, because we know he's already come. Well, if there were those who were saying, you know, we must be near the end of the world because, you know, the Bible says that you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, and we hear that all the time. Have you heard people say that? Maybe you've said that.
Facebook all the time. Every time something's in the news.
Yeah.
Shake my head.
Yeah.
But they missed the last part of the verse. Their question has to do with the end of what they perceive to be the end. And Jesus said, you'll hear wars and rumors of wars. See, it should be not trouble. These things must need come to pass, but the end is not yet. Dear friend of mine, he's dead now, but back years ago he told me that things were just as awful. He said, I don't believe things in our society could ever get any worse. He said, they're worse than they've ever been. I said, oh, Carl, be careful. You need to read about the city of Corinth because things have been a whole lot worse than they are now. They are. They're bad. But things have been a whole lot worse. And he quoted this passage and he said, well, you know, we hear of wars and rumors of war, yeah, but read the rest of it. Are wars and rumors of wars a sign of anything? No. That's not a sign of anything. How about somebody saying, I am the Christ? Is that a sign of anything? Oh, there's been false Christ in times gone by. And Jesus said they were to come. And then he said in verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and earthquakes in diverse places. But all these things are the beginning of travail. Now, you talk with people that not only talk about wars and rumors of wars, but they talk about famines and earthquakes, and they're all over the world. So we've got to be right close to the second coming of the Lord. You heard folks affirm that? Now, what is Jesus saying in this passage? Well, it's just the beginning, but the beginning of what?
Travail
of what? The end of time?
The end of the first
2 days. The end of, yeah, the destruction of Jerusalem.
You mentioned about the false Christ. Over in Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel was talking about some of those men that had led people astray. Thutis, in verse 36, claimed to be somebody. A group of about 400 men joined with him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census, drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered. And so he says, in the present case, I say, stay away from these men and let them alone, for this plan or actions of men that will be overthrown, but if it is of God, we will not be able to overthrow them, or else you might be found fighting against God. It's just interesting that even contemporary with the apostles, men claiming to be
Christ. Yeah. So it's not new. It wasn't a sign of anything. And when you're studying Matthew 24 in detail, I'd call your attention to note. Just make a list. It'd be pretty easy to do. Things that are not signs of anything that are identified in this passage. Richard?
Juan comments, he says, depending on where you live, this is happening all the time and has been happening.
Yeah.
I was going to make the same comment.
Yeah.
Name a generation where this hasn't been.
That's right.
Since Jesus
died. That's right. So these things that are being identified, Jesus said, don't let folks lead you astray. These aren't signs of anything, much less the fall of Jerusalem or the end of time. Yes.
So the English Standard Version calls it birth pains. So I looked it up, and the word says, properly, the pain of childbirth, figuratively the pain necessary to open up something new, i.e. to bring in more.
Okay, I'll buy that. I'll buy that, because the fall of Jerusalem would do that. It very well would do that, yes. But I think it's important for us to notice again our bookends, Randy. Our bookends, this generation, and then in verse 34, all these things shall come upon this generation. What generation? Those that Jesus was addressing. Now, he's not talking about his second coming, and we need to see that very clearly. Because this passage has been so perverted and so used to talk about the end of time, because that expression is used here, and the passage is not talking about that. That's not what Jesus has introduced to them. Now, there are some things that pertain to the end of time that maybe we need to discuss from even this context. But this context, this immediate context, is bookend with the expression, this generation. And I must admit to you, when we get down to verses 29 and following, those verses gave me all kinds of trouble until I began to study them further and how expressions are used in that text. Now, don't forget or forsake us and just go over there and read that and try to wade your way through it. Stay with me in this context, okay? But things that are discussed in this context from Matthew 23, verse 36, on to 24, verse 34, it's bookend. All this will occur in this generation. Now, if we can see that, then that helps us to solve the puzzle, so to speak. We've got this. Now, if you'll read further just a little bit in verse 9, it says, "Then shall they deliver you up into tribulation and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all the nations for my name's sake." Can you think of anybody, by the way, that was in that audience? How about the apostles? How about Stephen? How about James, who lost his head in Acts 12? Yeah, they're going to do this to you. Jesus, who's going to do it? This generation is going to do it to you folks. And they did. You can read about it in the text. "Ye shall be hated of all the nations for my name's sake. And then shall many stumble, and shall deliver up one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall arise, and shall lead many astray. And because iniquity shall be multiplied, the love of many shall wax cold." Well, hold that thought, if you would, and turn to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3, as you read there, beginning in verse 1. "O foolish Galatians, who did bewitch you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was openly set forth crucified? This only would I learn from you: receive ye the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Are ye so foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, are ye now perfected in the flesh? Did ye suffer so many things in vain, if indeed it be in vain? He therefore that supplieth you the Spirit of and worketh miracles among you, doeth he it by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith?" Now, as you read these verses, what comes to your mind? What were the Galatians being taught?
To go back to the law.
They were being taught, if you'll drop on down through the whole context, down into chapter 5. Some were binding circumcision upon them. We see that in Acts 15. Well, these were claiming to be prophets. They were claiming that the apostles had sent them from Jerusalem, Acts chapter 15. Wasn't so. They hadn't been sent by anybody. They were acting on their own and creating turmoil within the Lord's church. What's happened to their love? "The love of many shall wax cold." You remember, as we read in Revelation chapter 2 concerning the good church in Ephesus? Why are they rebuked? "You left your first love." The love of many shall wax cold. Let me ask you now, is that something new or something that precedes the second coming of the Lord? No, that's just normal stuff, isn't it? You read about that in the New Testament. That's not a sign of anything. But these are things that would occur. Now look at verse 13. "But he that cometh," or "he that endureth to the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then shall the end come." Now that's a real interesting statement. And it's interesting from this standpoint. First of all, "he that endureth to the end shall be saved." The end of what? Now we know, as we're studying other passages, for example, as we study from Revelation 2 verse 10, we know that we are to be faithful till death, and we'll receive the crown of life. Now, if you endure to the end of your life, you're going to be saved, right? All right. What about these in this audience that Jesus is talking to? These who would become, of course the church hadn't been established yet, but these who would become members of the Lord's church, they'd be faithful. Would they be saved? Yeah. Would they be saved from the coming destruction upon Jerusalem? What does he tell them to do in terms of being faithful? When you see something that is a sign, he's going to tell them what they are. What are they to do?
Flee.
All right, now if they flee to the mountains, will they be saved? Yeah. You do what I tell you. You be faithful. You'll be saved. I don't think at this point he's talking necessarily, though it is inferred, but not necessarily so, about salvation in heaven. But you'll be spared the destruction that everybody else is going to endure. You endure to the end. You'll be saved. You'll be faithful. Now, yes, you'll be saved in heaven, but you'll be saved from this danger of the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem. Now, let's look at verse 14. "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then shall the end come." The end of what? Look at your bookends again. Chapter 23, verse 36, and chapter 24, verse 34. The end of what?
Jerusalem and the system. Mm-hmm.
The end of Jerusalem and that Jewish system, yeah. Now, what's going to happen between the time Jesus is telling them this and the time Jerusalem falls?
the gospel be spread.
Sure will. Gospel be spread. Isn't that interesting? Now, you want to see that that's true? Turn over to Colossians chapter 1, Randy, and read for me verse 23. Colossians chapter 1, verse 23.
If indeed you continue in the faith firmly established and steadfast and not moved away by the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made minister.
Isn't that interesting? What did Jesus commission the apostles to do, according to Mark's account? Go and preach the gospel to every creature. Preach it to the whole creation. We learn in this passage that it would be preached to the whole world and to all the nations, and then shall the end come, the end of this Jewish system, the end of the city of Jerusalem. Gospel be preached to the whole creation. By the time Paul wrote Colossians 1, verse 23, where had the gospel been preached?
All creation.
To the whole creation. Now then, the real tough question, was that before or after the fall of the city of Jerusalem?
Before,
yes. The prison epistles were written approximately what time?
65.
A little before, perhaps 62, 63, right in there. That'd be a good answer. And when did Jerusalem fall?
70.
Right, Jesus said the gospel is going to be preached to the whole creation before Jerusalem falls. If indeed that's what the end is, and I believe that's what he's talking about here. Gospel will be preached to everybody before the end of Jerusalem falls or comes. Now, was it?
I think to all nations is the key to understanding that.
I believe it is.
That doesn't mean that every
individual
person on the face of the earth had heard the gospel.
No.
It means the nations had heard it.
That's right.
It was for everybody. Yeah, and it had been spread. Now somebody said, "Well, Mick, you're just nuts. You surely can't mean that the gospel had been preached to the whole creation by 30 plus years. Can't be so. Now, I've had this debate with folks. And we read in the scriptures of two primary characters in the book of Acts in particular. Who are they?
Peter
and Paul. Yes. And we read of the gospel being spread on several continents by Peter and Paul. Now, where did all the other apostles go? Where did the folks of that Peter and Paul, just those two, where did they go? Everywhere. Because we've got Jews represented as far away as Rome. And from Rome, you've got traveling. Yeah. The gospel spread. Now, I don't mean to tell you how it spread. I don't mean to try to identify who took it where. I can't do that. All I can do is read Colossians 1.
In his preaching journeys, Paul never went to Rome. In his preaching journeys, Peter never went to Rome. But Paul writes a book for the Christians at Rome.
Yes.
Where did they come from?
Well,
you go, yeah. It's been spread throughout the world. All of a sudden, Paul's writing to Christians whom he has never met, that are in a city he's never been to.
Yeah, go figure. How'd that work? You see, how'd that work? Well, Colossians 1 doesn't tell us all the hows, but it does tell us the fact. It had been spread throughout the creation. Now, things that are not signs, signs of anything. Somebody saying, I'm the Christ. Well, folks have been doing that. Wars and rumors of war, sign of nothing. Nations rising up and famines and earthquakes, signs of nothing. These things have always been. So if you're impressed with those things, you just keep on being impressed, but they're not signs of anything. And they're going to deliver you up. They'll punish and persecute those of you who are Christians. Well, that has been since the day of Jesus. They crucified him. We read in the scriptures of the apostles and Stephen and James and others that Saul, as it tells us in Acts 9, verse 1, breathed threatening and slaughter against the church. How many died at the hand of Saul alone? Well, we don't know, but many did. And not a sign of anything. You're going to be delivered up. You're going to be hated. False prophets arise. Not a sign of anything. The love of many waxing cold. Not a sign of anything. Not a sign of anything. Now, what would be a sign? Look at verse 15. When you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Let him that readeth understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee into the mountains. And we're going to talk about that some more. But what I want you to note is, now we've got a sign. The abomination of desolation. All right, we know exactly what that is, don't we? Yes, we do. We do. Somebody said, well, you know, we've got a confederation of Russia and a confederation of this nation, this, and we've got that all figured out, and that's the abomination of desolation. No, that wasn't what Daniel was talking about either. And so if we want to know what Daniel was talking about, we might do well to go back and read Daniel. And Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 is talking about the abomination of desolation, and what was he discussing in Daniel chapter 9? The end of time? All right, let's make this simple. A or B? A, the end of time. B, the destruction of Jerusalem. B. That's what Daniel was talking about. Now, when you see the abomination, here's what Daniel was talking about. But you know what? We don't have to wonder anymore. We don't have to even speculate and say, well, this is what Daniel was talking about. Because we can confer with the other Gospels and be clear on that. Turn, if you will, to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. And drop your finger down to verse 20. Now, just so you know that the context is the same under consideration from Matthew chapter 24, I just invite your attention to the verses surrounding Luke chapter 21, verse 20 through 24. And you'll see that the context is the same consideration. But having done that, let's read verse 20. Starting. But when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. Then let them that are in Judea flee unto the mountains. And let them that are in the midst of her depart out. And let not them that are in the country enter therein. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress upon the land, and wrath unto this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led captive unto all the nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, unto the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now what's Luke describing? But let's start over. Is Luke describing the same thing that Matthew's describing? Yeah. So what's Luke describing?
The destruction of Jerusalem.
Destruction of Jerusalem. All right. Now we've noted things that are not signs, but now here is a sign. When you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel, then flee to the mountains. What does Luke tell us the abomination of desolation was?
Armies surrounding
the city. Well, now taking a quick look back into history, what army surrounded the city?
Rome.
Rome destroyed Jerusalem. That's a matter of historical fact. It was not the only time Jerusalem was destroyed, but Rome did destroy the city in 70 A.D. Now, when Jesus is sitting with the disciples and telling them, you see all these buildings, time going to come, one stone won't be left upon another. How sad that is. I would have gathered you together as a chicken gathers her chicken under her wing, and you wouldn't do it. But now here's what's coming. What's going to be signs of, well, this is not it, this is not it, this is not, but this is. When you see the Roman armies encompass the city, it's time to get out. Now, there's a lot of really interesting history to the fall of the city of Jerusalem. It came in waves, like sometimes destruction does, and between waves was an opportunity for these people to flee the city. And we're going to look at that perhaps at another time, but I want to look down at verse 17 now. Matthew 24. He said, let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out his things that are in the house. And let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. Now that's just exactly parallel to what we read in Luke's account. Now I want to call your attention to the plurality of the term days. In those days, Jerusalem didn't fall overnight. typically, the way that a city was destroyed was the opposing army would throw a circle around the walls of the city. Now, we talked about this in other studies. In fact, when Jerusalem fell under King Nebuchadnezzar and so forth, but when we talked about it then, we talked about how that typically a city, an ancient city, would be destroyed, especially one that had walls. Walls are really good to protect you from people that are on the other side of the wall. But they also present a very negative factor if you are under besiegement for any length of time. What happens inside the city?
Run out of food. Run out of food. Yeah.
Well, let's just go over to the next town and get some more. Well, can't do that because there's an army outside the wall. We can't go out there. We'll be killed if we go out there. But what's going to happen to us if we stay in here? We're going to starve to death. All right. Now we've talked about some other tactics that opposing army utilized, and quite efficiently. We think sometimes that germ warfare is kind of a new invention. No, they would take what was called a machine, essentially a catapult, and take a dead body and put it on the catapult and throw it over the wall. Now, if you put a dead body on a catapult, somebody that died of some horrible disease, what's going to now be in the city? Horrible disease. So people are starving. Number one. And now you've just introduced a deadly disease among them. And what is their immunity system going to be like to? No. You see the point. It becomes a weapon. A weapon of war. Destruction by disease. And that's what they did. Now when you see the army forming, what do? You leave. Because if they get the city completely encompassed, you won't be able to go. Now again, we want to note that this came in waves. So between waves, they were able to leave the city just as Jesus said. Don't go down into your house and get something. Why not? You may not have time to gather anything. Don't folks tell you when you board an airplane, you leave your belongings behind? If they tell you get off the plane, you get off the plane. Now why? Well, if everybody's trying to gather up their overhead baggage, what's going to happen? Well, nobody's going to get off the plane. They'll become an obstacle in the way of everybody that's trying to escape, and so it would be doomed to everybody. So if you see the Roman army around your city, get out! Doesn't that seem simple? Don't go back, try to gather things. As you look down in the next part of the passage, in verse 20, and pray, verse 20, Matthew 24, pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on a Sabbath. And what did they do to the city of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day? Close the gates. Okay, so you can't get out on the Sabbath day. Now why would they close the gates on the Sabbath day? Not supposed to travel and not supposed to do business. That's right. Not supposed to have folks in here selling their wares and all that kind of thing. All right, so the gates were closed on the Sabbath day. And he said, pray that it's not in the wintertime. What happens in the wintertime? In the mountains. It gets cold. Snow. Life's in jeopardy. You see food, shelter, clothing, all a problem in the wintertime. So you pray that it's not in the wintertime. You pray it's not on the Sabbath day. And then verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation such as hath not been from the beginning of the world unto now, no sure shall ever be. Now it's at this point that probably a good read of Josephus' material, who was a Jewish historian commissioned by Rome to write the history of the Jews, and he describes the fall of Jerusalem in horrible, horrible terms. Just to summarize, over 1 million Jews died in the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And we look back at the Holocaust and we say, well, how many died in the Holocaust? A whole lot of folks died in the Holocaust, but I think the number is 6 million.
Six million Jews.
That's certainly so. But we're talking about the Jews in this instance. So a million Jews died in this one city, Josephus tells us. Now, how did they die? Well, they died by the opposing army. They died by starvation. They died by disease. In fact, Josephus tells the story about a woman that somehow had food, and the Roman soldiers smelled something cooking. And they went to see what was left to cook, and she was cooking her son. Now, that causes you to stare rather soberly, don't it? Indeed. They walked away and left her. Now, when you read about the tribulation of this text, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. He's using some very vivid terms to describe what happened when Jerusalem fell. And if you'll read on, it says, and except those days, once again, notice it's plural, except those days have been shortened, no flesh would have been saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Again, a plurality of days, a besiegement and conquering doesn't occur overnight. And then he says in verse 23, if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is the Christ, or here, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christ. Well, he's already told us that, hasn't he? There shall arise false Christ and false prophets. Already told us that. And shall show great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if be possible, even the elect. He said, behold, I have told you beforehand. If therefore they shall say unto you, behold, ye in the wilderness, go not forth where Jesus tell them to go. Go to the mountains. But here's somebody claiming to be a prophet or the Christ, and they're saying, go to the wilderness. What did Jesus say? Don't go there. He said, behold, he's in the inner chambers. Believe it not. For as the lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen even unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man, or shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Now, what we want to note from verse 27 is something similar to what you read in Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. Revelation 1, verse 7. You won't have to have somebody to tell you when this is occurring. It'll be something you'll be able to see. You won't have to have a prophet or a Christ or somebody say, he's here, he's there. You'll see it. All right?
Well, that's the strange thing I find about people that want to say that this destruction of Jerusalem stuff has got to be the end of the world. You will not be able to flee from the second. You don't run to the mountains because God won't be able to get you there.
And I won't help you. No, he'll be there too.
And you talk, you know, later on in the New Testament, it talks about how when our bodies are changed, it'll be in the twinkling of an eye.
Yeah.
Not some long, drawn-out process like this
no.
is talking about.
No, not at all. Well, I've done something I really didn't intend to do tonight. I plowed a little deeper into this. In verse 28, we've read that, so I've got to talk about it. Just a smidgen. Yeah, just got to talk about it. Wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Some translations may use the word vulture. Mine's got a footnote, vultures be gathered together. When you're driving down the highway and you look over here and you see a bunch of vultures circling, what do you know?
Something dead
over there. Yeah, something dead. And what would bring the vultures to Jerusalem? A lot of dead bodies. A lot of carnage would be in the city of Jerusalem. Now, interestingly enough, just a little side note, you know what the Roman emblem standard was that they carried around? Eagles. Yeah, yeah, they carried that. So some think that's what's referenced here. It very well may be that the Roman standard would be where you see all these dead bodies. But again, we note and underscore that the writer is describing the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. He's not talking about the end of time. And you'll notice the plurality of days. You'll notice the location, that it is specific. Where they are to flee to, it is specific. And so we want to pick up, probably not at this, Randy, if you're going to teach a class next week, probably not at this, unless you just want to. I can send you some more material that will deal with this, but I think I'd rather just have you go ahead with what we planned and do a review. Yeah, questions. Yeah, yeah. But that's enough. All right, Richard.
So we talked about the generation thing, and you mentioned. Well, Brenda might want to look that up. So she did comment here. She said, "Don't interrupt." But there it is. It says in Numbers 32:13.
Okay.
It says, "So the Lord's anger was aroused against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone."
Excellent. Excellent. And that's in Numbers 32.
Numbers 32, verse 13.
Okay. The word generation not used then in Numbers 14, I guess.
And doesn't Scripture say that Jesus isn't going to touch foot on the ground when he comes back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It says he's going to come in the clouds. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's not going to come to the earth. Yeah, and we'll look at that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. for that conduct. We'll meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. Good study tonight. Thank you so much for your time and your attention. And Brenda, thank you for looking that up.